Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
The future of 3D printed rockets and vacation plans for Mars rovers. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The first 3D printed rocket launched from Cape Canaveral back in March. While its second stage and payload failed to reach orbit, Relativity Space says it was a success and is moving forward with a newer rocket. We'll speak with Relativity Space's CEO, Tim Ellis, about what it's like to craft and launch these innovative rockets and what his engineers are learning from the company's first launch earlier this year. Then, everyone needs a vacation, even rovers. We'll speak with University of Florida's Amy Williams about why the robot explorers on Mars are taking 3 weeks off. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Commercial company Relativity Space is creating reusable rockets, all with 3D printing. The company had a successful send-off of its Terran 1 rocket back in March, and while the second stage and payload didn't reach orbit, the company is not slowing down with production of its new vehicle, Terran R. Here to talk about that test flight and how it's helping prepare for the next launch of a 3D printed rocket in 2026 is Tim Ellis, the co-founder and CEO of Relativity Space. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Good to see you again, Brendan. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so Tim, first, I have got to set the record straight here because ahead of the launch of Terran 1, your team was kind enough to let me tour your facility and your vehicle, and I touched the second stage as a part of this tour, and I want to make sure that you didn't find anything related to what happened after that launch comes back to me, right?
No, absolutely not. It is, that stage, even after you touched it, it had already gone through a full stage test. The engine had been tested a full flight duration. So yeah, it was all good.
Okay, Tim, I can finally sleep after hearing that from you. So thank you. Let's talk, because while I was there, I mean, I did get to see the facility. I've got to imagine that that was an incredible moment for you, your team, and your company. Take me back to that launch day when you saw that vehicle leave the pad.
Yeah, well, I think one thing, you know, particularly personal to my story on this. So when I started Relativity, I was very young. I was 25. I worked at Jeff Bezos' company, Blue Origin. I was a propulsion engineer, so I saw lots of rocket engine tests. I did, you know, rocket launches in college, but I was so busy building my own rockets in college and then working at Blue Origin that I'd never stopped to go see an orbital rocket test. So when I started Relativity, I actually maybe somewhat masochistically told myself I was going to wait to watch an orbital launch until it was a rocket built by our own company.
So I
was
seriously?
So I was out at Cape Canaveral many times. You know, SpaceX has launched a ton and I always had to look away and close my ears. And you know, I really, truly was committed to having a Terran 1 and our methane-fueled 3D printed rocket be the first thing that I saw. So when I saw the fold downs retract backwards and the rocket start to move up, I knew at the point we let it go, this thing is definitely flying and it's on its way to space. And so I ran out the back door, went out, saw it with my own eyes. And again, I'd seen engine tests before, but of course, watching this rocket flying was super emotional experience. It was, you know, for me, not just personally impactful, but also just knowing that this thing was 3D printed. It was the first methane fueled rocket outside of China in the world to ever attempt to even launch to orbit and space. And so there were a lot of brand new technologies, most privately backed brand new rocket companies. The launch vehicle only lasts about 15 to 30 seconds max before something serious goes wrong, whether an engine blows up or, you know, the rocket falls back on the launch pad. Certainly, I don't want to trivialize it. Those failures are terrible, but like they happen very commonly for a brand new rocket, even with the extensive ground testing companies do. in my case, I was very ahead in the game, cheering it on, but also just watching the live stream simultaneously on my phone, counting the seconds to 80 seconds, which was max Q, the kind of max stress point on the rocket. That was really our goal, to exceed that point. And so once we exceeded that, then I felt a pretty big wave of confidence that we were going to get through the full first stage flight, which we ended up doing.
I find it quite endearing that you were watching most of that flight the way that the rest of us were, with our eyes and on the live stream. That's really cool.
Yeah, of course, I was, you know, at the day of launch, we have a really well-trained team, so I didn't have a lot to do. I mean, certainly had to prepare in case there was a very serious anomaly and earlier in the mission or we didn't achieve our goal. Like, I was mostly just mentally preparing for that. But honestly, I was there just to support the team, like cheer on the hard work that everybody had done. But everybody was very head in the game, professionally focused. And we're all, you know, very excited that we exceeded our goal for that mission, made it all the way to space. I can also tell you, because nobody had even flown a methane-fueled rocket to orbit before, we didn't really anticipate how beautiful the launch was going to be either, with the blue flame and the crazy photos that came out of it. We really just didn't anticipate just how alien that was going to look. It was pretty gorgeous.
As it being your first launch, did that moment meet your expectations that you had? And I think I know the answer to this.
I think I felt two dominant emotions. One was just an absolutely surreal level of adrenaline and like existential adrenaline. But I also just felt a lot of pride, and pride of, you know, especially in our case, since it was 3D printed rocket. When I started the company, I didn't even know if we could 3D print anything bigger than a cubic foot of size. You know, nobody had ever done that before. So for us, just the stacking miracles and kind of technology developments that had to exist, even to get to that moment, was just so absurdly high. We really feel good about the first launch and the customer need for there to be now a reusable rocket. So all of the technologies and experience we've developed in Terran 1 were originally architected to be able to scale to something larger. Everything from the gas generator cycle engine, to the methane propulsion systems, to a lot of the 3D printing technology we proved with Terran 1, all of that was hard to develop and get an initial rocket to the launch pad. But since we did take that bigger bite initially, now I feel like we have more momentum towards a much bigger rocket.
Let's talk about that next step, Tim, because as you mentioned, the scalability of going from Terran 1 to Terran R, that was intentional. Let's talk about what you've learned from Terran 1 that you're applying to Terran R, and where the team is at now in the process of applying those lessons learned.
Yeah, so I think how it's ended up playing out is really Terran 1 is like a concept car, and we proved a bunch of technologies, in some cases well ahead of their time, I think, with 3D printing, and really pushed the boundaries of what's possible to get Terran 1 to work. So just like a concept car, we're looking at Terran R as our mass market product that is really focused on solving this core customer problem. And the problem we are increasingly hearing from customers is that there's actually just not enough medium to heavy lift launch supply to launch all of these low Earth orbit and telecom constellations and next generation services that people want to develop. So we're just seeing so much more demand. And then when it comes to supply of, like, well, then who are the rocket companies that exist that can actually serve this huge demand? It's a pretty short list. Of course, SpaceX has been phenomenally successful at increasing ramp rate and launch rate. But, you know, we're seeing that there's likely needing to be a diversified player, again, that's not building their own telecom network. You know, in that list, it's really an unclaimed trophy, like, you know, essentially to be the second great launch company, because a lot of the traditional ones that are tried and true, you know, they have signed launch contracts. In some cases, they're either commercially quite expensive or they're not really tuned because of their corporate structure and engineering structure to really have high, you know, quickly scaling ramp rate of launches. Like, there's not a lot of reusability. And so I think the jury's out on who's going to be that next player. I think the dramatic irony of this a little bit is we had actually been working on this transition probably for the last 2 years, even before the Terran 1 launch. We started to see signs, not that the one-ton payload class wasn't a viable market. I still think it is. It's just less interesting, and there was a bigger problem. And we just long thought, there's got to be another company that's doing reusable rockets and making quick progress and being aggressive and has like disruptive capabilities, because I just don't want to live in a world where there is a monopoly and there's only one company. And I think that's a world we're increasingly headed towards.
I was going to ask you, you know, had there had been plans to keep Terran 1 in your arsenal, it seems like there were. It seems like you've transitioned that. Is there still a place for Terran 1, though, if there is someone who wants to launch a smaller payload like that? Or has it just been shelved as the proof of concept?
You know, I'd never say never. Certainly, we still get approached by people with interest. Again, there is a market for it. You know, it's something that we see very clearly just because we're in conversation, negotiation, NDA with almost every satellite company out there. So we do see a very kind of under the hood view of the market. The truth is, yeah, like the one ton payload class, there are payloads out there that people are interested in. I think the one that's really seen a huge erosion of demand is more like the 150 to 200 kilogram, 250 kilogram payload class. I think CubeSats, that has really been eroded. And the biggest reason is availability of transporter missions. A lot of those companies were just more early stage venture backed, like their total launch needs were just not as high. And I think other companies doing a lot of those launches have even said stuff like that publicly, that it's demand limited and the market just didn't materialize. In 110 payload class, I think it could be there. The biggest thing for us, though, is actually something, you know, even I learned in my prior life, which was focus. We realized Terran R and have a humble respect for the development ahead of us. I think we have a killer team. We're now over 1,000 people. You know, we're certainly taking an optimization on top of that. Like, I think Terran R is really, you know, a very commercially focused, optimized rocket to be reusable without doing anything too wacky and too kind of unproven and sciencey, because our goal is really just to get to market quickly and scale the ramp rate very quickly. But yeah, I think the answer really is we just felt confident to do Terran R, and that Terran 1, we were selling at about 12 million to 15 million a launch. So even if we did something like a dozen launches over the next 2 years, which would have taken a pretty good amount of effort still, it just wouldn't have provided that much revenue and profit relative to Terran R itself. So we just thought being focused and not having any delays on Terran R by distracting ourselves with continuing Terran 1 launch operations was a more efficient use of resources. Now, we do have the launch pad out at the Cape. Like, we're building the Terran R pad next to it. So technically, there's still a Terran 1 pad that, you know, we could resurrect. But we are repurposing a lot of the infrastructure then at NASA's Stennis Space Center to support AONR, Terran R testing, and that's all very actively underway.
I was asking just to see if I could find in my budget a use for Terran 1, and I don't think I can find 12 million hanging around, but I'll let my CFO know, see if we can find something to do that with. Let's talk a bit about the Terran R, you know, ramping up for that. You see you're building the facilities here at the Cape. Where are you when it comes to that first launch? When can we expect that?
Yeah, sure. So we're tracking to 2026. So between now and then, there's definitely going to be a lot of milestones. So this rocket had already been in development about for the last 3 years. So we had been architecting it. We were figuring out the payload size. And we really are being customer focused and market focused. Customers do not care if the second stage is reusable. Candidly, they don't care if the first stage is reusable. They just want the initial ascent launch to work. In our case, first stage reusability, of course, does provide better economics and a much stronger business case than second stage reuse. And so we're just prioritizing that. We're working to do our first engine test this year and then a full flight duration test the beginning of next year. So the engine program is going very well. Everything's hit 100% power. It's pretty cool. I will say this engine is about 11 times more powerful than Aeon 1, but you know, these kind of tests are pretty crazy. We test everything at Stennis Space Center. I know depending on humidity and those kind of conditions, we've actually set off car alarms in a city 35 miles away once. So
it's pretty wild. Well, Tim, let me just end this conversation with this question. And that is, have you seen another launch since Terran 1, or are you holding off until Terran R?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I literally saw a Falcon 9 launch the next day. It was the next thing or the day after, and I watched it. It was very cool. You know, I missed the blue flame, though. I could get used to this. The next generation of rockets with methane propellants are definitely different looking and pretty cool. So
Well, I'm looking forward to another Blue Flame launch. So Tim Ellis is the co-founder and CEO of Relativity Space. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Brendan. Appreciate it.
Still to come, rovers need rest too. What's the plan for a Martian robot vacation? That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
For 3 weeks on Mars, the Red Planet enters a phase called conjunction, where Mars is on the other side of the Sun. So the Sun is between Mars and Earth. That means scientists cannot communicate with any of the rovers on Mars. So what's a rover to do for this 3-week blackout? Well, here to talk about this period of silence from our neighboring planet is Amy Williams, an astrobiologist at the University of Florida and scientist on NASA's robotic missions. Amy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
So we're chatting with each other. We're able to chat with each other. But I think it's really ironic that you are not able to chat with Perseverance, right? I invited you on here to talk about Perseverance and you can't chat with it. So tell me what's going on.
Yeah, not right now. So right now we are entering conjunction. Conjunction for people of a certain age range, I would say. The first thing that might come to mind is conjunction junction.
What's your function?
And I salute you. Yes, if you recognize that. But in the scheme of Mars exploration, conjunction is the time when Mars is on the other side of the Sun relative to Earth. And although our deep space network is highly capable, we cannot talk through the Sun. We actually get about 3 weeks every roughly 2 years where we are in conjunction and Mars is behind the Sun relative to Earth. So I like to refer to it as our Marscation. I get a little vacation from Mars, which I think most people say, why would you ever want a vacation? But, you know, every single day with the rover, everyone needs a vacation once in a while.
Everyone needs a little time away, that's for sure. So what happens with Percy during this conjunction? Is it just frozen in time?
So we've got a few operations that can continue. So this is, you know, Perseverance. This is Curiosity. This is all of our orbital assets. Everybody is kind of hanging out waiting for commanding from Earth. But we can ask the rovers to do a couple of low energy things. So nothing is going to move. We're not going to drive. We're not even going to move the mast where the cameras are so you can kind of look around. So what we do is we sit in one place, sort of like the statue game. Things that we can do are like change detection observations. So if you have the cameras facing something like a wind ripple, over the course of these 3 Earth weeks, you can probably see that ripple change, you know, and move by taking a picture every day. You know, we have our atmospheric instruments that are monitoring, and so they're going to continue to collect data while we aren't able to tell the rovers to do anything, but it can function autonomously at this level without us until it comes back around the Sun and we can check in again.
Mm-hmm. And the important point, you know, for not having it move around or do anything very strenuous is in case it runs into trouble, right? Because it can't phone home during these 3 weeks.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, so much has progressed in our ability to enable like autonomous driving especially with Perseverance, and Curiosity has capability as well in a slightly more limited fashion. But for example, I mean, you can look at the rover tracks, you know, with different assets that NASA runs. And you can see actually where we sort of went in a circle with Perseverance recently, because the AutoNav, you know, we were trying to navigate this boulder field and the mesh wasn't far enough out and it couldn't quite do it. And so we went in this circle. And so when we log in the next day and we see like, why are we back where we started? These kinds of things can happen. So we do try to keep what's called ground in the loop. So we on the ground or in the loop on what's happening. So yeah, no driving, no moving the arms, no moving even the mast, just in case something goes wrong. Because otherwise, then you're going to interrupt all of those autonomous observations that we've asked the rovers to do.
How much planning goes into these 3 weeks? You mentioned it happens about every 2 years. It's not just for Perseverance. Like you said, it's for Curiosity and all of the other robots on Mars. Is there a lot of planning that goes into these 3 weeks?
you know, we at this point, we've been exploring Mars long enough with rovers that we sort of have a cadence. We know what we're going to be able to do. So it's a lot easier than it used to be. We kind of know what our limitations are. One of the big things that we try to do, though, is we try to get in position and ready to go in case there is some kind of fault you need to resolve 3 or more days in advance of when conjunction actually happens. So we count down C-3, C-2, C-1 to when we truly can't command anymore, because we just want to make sure there are no faults. There's nothing we've left hanging. And so getting to the location you want to be in, you know, not just for safety, like you can pretty readily angle the rover so that you have the ability to communicate with Earth once you're back around the sun, even if you lose connection with the orbital assets. You know, all these things just to make sure that we're in a safe position. But, you know, then there's that pressure of like, all right, we got to drive because we want to be parked on this unit to take this beautiful panorama that we can sit and look at for, you know, the time that we're in conjunction.
Well, 3 weeks of not being able to talk to Percy and these rovers, really just a drop in the bucket with how long Percy's been on Mars, right? I mean, you said your team has celebrated another big milestone for this mission, right? How many souls has it been?
Well, so Perseverance, we're getting close to 1,000 souls with Perseverance, and we just passed 4,000 souls with Curiosity. And so a soul is a Martian day, so it's longer even than an Earth day. So these are pretty incredible milestones when you think back to that pressure of when we're about to land and hoping that everything went well and all the science and exploration we get to do. And now we're 4,000 souls into it. And so one of the fun things that we do as a team is for these kinds of, you know, milestones, we end up making t-shirts. I kind of feel like I'm in college again, like we have t-shirts commemorating events now. But it's one of the really fun, you know, community building things that what we do. And it just seems so, you know, small and tiny in the grand scheme. But, you know, it's a lot of fun to be able to commemorate these kind of big things that these missions are able to accomplish.
It's certainly worth celebrating. And let's talk about some of the things that they are accomplishing. With Perseverance, you know, you've been keeping us up to speed on what's going on with the mission. You mentioned before we started recording that you're about to leave Jezero Crater, right? I mean, this is a big step for Perseverance, isn't it?
Yep. That was our initial destination, you know, for very good reasons. But it's always good to remember that there's, I guess, if it's not the grass is greener, what is it? The rocks are redder on the outside of the crater. There's so much more to explore, and you're getting into a totally different, an environment that was generated, formed, whatever, at a very different time. So we're getting ready to see some really ancient rocks when we drive out of Jezero Crater. But we're not quite ready yet. We're still in the margin unit. We're still exploring this area from orbit that's really intrigued us since before landing, you know, one of the reasons that we even wanted to go to Jezero. So there's still a lot to do in Jezero, but we are approaching that time when we will leave Jezero and explore beyond.
Tell me about this margin region. Why are you so excited to explore it?
Well, the margin has looked a little bit different from the images that we take from our orbital assets. It has these geochemical signatures of carbonate. And carbonate is a rock that can form in a couple of different ways. One of the ways is sometimes in a lake margin, and we know that Jezero was a lake at one point. There are other ways to make carbonate in this area. You know, we know that it's filled up with igneous rocks, like basalts, things that you might see from a volcano, for example. And when water interacts with those rocks, you can also generate carbonate. And so one of the big questions has been, is this the kind of thing you would see at the margin of a lake, or is this the kind of thing that you see because water was kind of moving through these lava flows? And this is sort of that secondary product that comes from that weathering reaction. So we've been really curious about what that answer is. And we're just getting ready, you know, starting to explore. We've taken a sample here and we have so many questions still to answer about what the margin is and what it represents, both for Jezero as well as sort of like this whole time frame we're exploring.
You said you grabbed a sample. How long are you going to be spending in this margin region? Not you, but the rover. You know what I meant, right?
I mean, mentally, I'm spending time there too. Yeah, I mean, we are, you know, moving expeditiously towards the exit out of Jezero Crater. So, you know, there's a couple of other locations we identified from orbit that are really interesting that we'll drive by during our exit. And, you know, we may invest some time in exploring these to better understand the context. What is this unit? Why is it here? Why did it form? And that's what we've been doing from the crater floor onto the delta and fan, and then onto the margin before we leave the crater itself. So we've got a little bit more time to try to understand what all of this is before we leave and start exploring new terrain.
And will Percy ever return to Jezero, or is this it?
Nominally, this is it. The original plan was for us to go out and collect samples outside of Jezero and then cache all of that for Mars sample return. The first cache that we made at the Three Forks area, which is on the Jezero crater floor, it's this extremely flat, seems like a really safe place to send, you know, a lander and some helicopters to retrieve those samples. And so the intent is not to return to Jezero, but depending on what Mars sample return needs in order to be successful, you know, I think that our mobility is one of our strengths in being able to move around. But we have a lot of samples to collect outside of Jezero before we can think about that.
Gotcha. Let's talk about Curiosity, because you mentioned you passed 4,000 sols and it's doing some drilling in a very interesting region right now. Tell me a bit about what Curiosity and the team is investigating.
So yeah, with Curiosity, we've been exploring what we call the sulfate-bearing unit. So sulfates made of sulfur and oxygen, and these tend to form, at least in this environment, where you have water that's evaporating. So if you picture, you know, if you have some salt water, you leave it out to evaporate, you're left with some salts at the bottom of your dish when you're done. And that is effectively what happened as Gale Crater and, you know, Mars was drying out and desiccating. And so we have these units that have abundant sulfate salts, carbonates as well, things that seem to have precipitated out of an evaporating aqueous environment. We're talking about rivers and lakes and things. So in this area, we've got these cool bands that we saw from orbit. We call them the light and dark tone bands. And we've been trying to understand, what's the color difference? Is it compositional? Is it just one of these erodes differently? And so you have a lot of sand on it. And so we've completed our first drill hole in the area. We named it Sequoia. So we're naming everything in this quadrangle after targets from the Sierra Nevadas in California. And we are just getting data down from that. So we'll get time to like process those data during conjunction and be able to come back and have a better sense for what is the difference between these units? Why are we seeing this distinct layering from orbit?
And is this investigation strictly geological, or could this have something to do with astrobiology? You mentioned water. We're looking for water there. And if you're seeing water evaporation, that might be signs of life, right?
Yeah, everything's astrobiology for me. Yeah, so one of the cool things about sulfates is depending on how they evaporate or precipitate from water, they have the capability to sort of trap microorganisms and preserve them. If there was life at that place at that time, and it happened to be trapped in one of these minerals, yeah, there's a potential that you could see something. You know, as an astrobiologist, always my hope. But the reality is, if you have water evaporating, you probably have a pretty harsh environment that's becoming more and more potentially dangerous for microorganisms. Of course, there are microorganisms that love living in salt, but if it's happening quickly, perhaps they don't have time to adapt to that. There's always all these caveats I have to include, because the search for life beyond Earth is so important. We got to get it right when we think we do see something. So I'm always interested in water and habitable environments on Mars. And this is just giving us really great insight into an environment that we really haven't had that much opportunity to explore on Mars yet.
And finally, Amy, when will this conjunction end and you can call your rovers once more?
Around the end of November. So we get to have Thanksgiving in the U.S., which is very nice of the rovers and the sun to allow us to do this. But yeah, around the end of November, we'll be able to make contact again and check in with our rovers and our orbiters and start getting back to the awesome science we get to do.
Amy Williams is an astrobiologist at the University of Florida and a scientist on the Perseverance and Curiosity rovers. Amy, thanks again for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit WMFE.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Alessandro Bonaiuto. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.